Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For the first time in nearly 50 years, public support for the death penalty has dropped below 50%. But capital punishment is the law of the land in 30 states, including Ohio. And in February, after a nearly three-year hiatus, Ohio will resume executions using a new three-drug combination. We wanted to talk about why the change of heart about the death penalty today. Coming up, we'll hear from a death penalty supporter. Joining us now by phone is former Ohio Attorney General Jim Petro. Welcome back.
Good morning, Ann. How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Good.
You were a member of the Ohio House in 1981 and co-sponsor of the bill that brought the death penalty back to Ohio. Now you oppose the death penalty. Can you talk about, the trajectory of your change of heart?
You know, I sure can. I became a lawyer in 1973 and was at that time an assistant county prosecutor in Franklin County. I saw criminal conduct firsthand in that job. And so when I joined the legislature in 81, the bill was already passing the Senate, came over to the House, and it was focused on the worst of the worst. And we kept talking about that. The definitions of those who might be subject to the death penalty were the most evil of evil perpetrators you could imagine. And we were also convinced that it would obviously be a cost savings for the state. We'd have the ability to avoid the incarceration costs for a life. We could protect from further crimes in the event that a convicted murderer were to break free in some way. And from all that, we expected uniformity, that it would be applied uniformly around the state. There'd be some consistency to it. It would make a great deal of sense and have logic to it. Thereafter, there were no executions until 1999, so it took 18 years after the law became law in Ohio before it was finally applied. Circumstances have changed dramatically, and you know, I'll let you ask more questions about it, but I can tell you why some of the factors that convinced legislators like myself to vote for the death penalty really never occurred.
Well, let me ask you this. Before I do, I just want to remind folks you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about how people come to a change of heart one way or the other about the death penalty. My guest right now is Jim Petro, former Ohio Attorney General, and also a member of the Ohio General Assembly. He was a member of the House and co-sponsor of the bill in 1981 that re-legalized the death penalty in the state of Ohio. You made the salient point. It was 19 years after it was legalized again before Wilford Berry was executed on February 19th, 1999. And I'm wondering, that span of time, what did you learn during that time?
You know, I can't really reflect on any lessons learned during that period. Just that it would be a long and costly process before someone would finally be executed because of all the appeals and the litigation that would follow. I mean, with every death sentence, there would be another 15 years of litigation before you'd actually have to face the prospect of real punishment. So it really wasn't applying the law very quickly, nor could it be with all the rights to appeal. And that appeal cost was overwhelming, and the time and personnel cost was overwhelming. Those are some of the factors that caused me to start having some second thoughts about it. But one of the most important factors from my perspective was the risk of innocence. You might recall that when I was Attorney General, I encountered a death penalty case of an individual who'd been in prison for 7 years. At that point, I think his death sentence had been commuted. But at the point where I got involved in that case, and that was the case of Clarence Elkins, we were developing the view within the Attorney General's office that this man was absolutely innocent of a crime. And so the prospect of innocence began to weigh heavily on me. I never would have believed that people convicted and convictions upheld through the entire legal process could possibly be innocent. But as you know, the Innocence Movement and the Innocence Project, and I've become engaged in that in my retirement. It's kind of where I really base my activities now. There are a lot more people innocent that are ultimately convicted of crimes than we would ever have imagined. The number of innocent exonerations to this point is well over 1,800. And of course, those are unique cases where someone who's been convicted can actually find proof that rises to the top that can prove their innocence.
When we're saying innocence, we're not talking about maybe they weren't the trigger man. We're talking about absolute innocence.
Absolutely. People who did not commit the crime and may not have engaged in criminal conduct in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. They weren't necessarily a logical suspect because of criminal behavior. They happened to be maybe in the wrong place in the wrong time, maybe misidentified through wrongful identification, any number of factors. And there's actually six major contributing factors that contribute to wrongful conviction. But wrongful conviction in our criminal justice system is a serious problem. We do convict, probably, and I'm not overstating this, every day somewhere in the United States, innocent people are being convicted by juries or by judges of criminal acts that they didn't commit. And that's just, you know, the flaw in the system. And my advocacy now is trying to take steps to overcome those flaws. But with those flaws in mind, execution becomes more problematic. You don't ever want to execute an innocent person. And it has already happened. There's Troy Davis in Atlanta, mm-hmm. in Georgia, a number of years ago. Most everyone concludes now that he was most likely innocent. There was Michael Morton, who came very close to being executed and was ultimately exonerated. There's many, many people who've been through this process and could have been executed, but weren't. And fortunately, later they were exonerated.
And most of this has to do with DNA evidence now?
The DNA has changed everything. And because of DNA, we now have conclusive proof of innocence, or that otherwise might not have existed. But it's even more than that, Anne. The thoughts that we had in 1981 that we would save a lot of money without long-term incarceration just never proved to be true. Actually, executions are far more costly than the states bearing the cost of life in prison without parole. The costliness really arises through the enormous appellate process, which becomes a lot of legal cost, and then all of the other elements. It takes so many years to get through it. The cost of that really is really far in excess of the cost of imprisoning somebody for life without parole. There's also no uniformity. It depends on the prosecutor.
The county, that sort of thing.
Yeah. A prosecutor can choose to indict with death penalty specifications or not. And in some counties, they may choose to do that because of personal view that they don't want to have too many death penalties, because of perhaps the cost view that's expressed to them by the county government that basically says, go easy. Mm-hmm. When you have a death case, it costs the county a lot more money. Mm-hmm. Those are all factors that cause people to think, as a prosecutor perhaps, or as a local government, we want to try to avoid capital cases. All of that lack of uniformity, that greater cost factor, causes a lot of people to now look at this and say, it's just not worth it, coupled with the risk of error, because the error you can't take back.
Well, we are seeing the numbers change among Americans. We're seeing that it's to a historic low, below 50%, around, I guess, 43% right now. You know, as a Republican, lifelong Republican, what's your sense about why Ohio still embraces it as a criminal justice strategy?
Ohio is a conservative state, obviously much more so. We were a fairly early state to take up the, after the Supreme Court finally struck down the death penalty in 1978. There were a number of cases that led up to it. Ohio was one of the earliest states to reenact. Ohio is a conservative state where we have a conservative citizenry, and their, legislators and legislatures follow the course that's kind of looks to be the favored course of the population. And I believe in 1981, the favored view of Ohioans was to have a death penalty for the worst of the worst. And that's why it was adopted. Today, I think, as you know, you've just cited the statistics, it is no longer the majority view. It is no longer the popular view. And I think we need to really reconsider what the values of it is, you know, versus the dangers. Again, I look at the greatest danger of making a mistake. Because of my involvement in innocence cases, I know that we convict people wrongfully. When we convict people wrongfully and then undertake the ultimate punishment, you know, that is truly one of the greatest, that is the greatest injustice you can encounter.
So Republican lawmakers who are maybe wrestling with this issue, have they come to you and to talk to you about what your thoughts are?
I've had informal conversations with many people, both in the legislature today or in local government, in public service. Nancy and I, because we write about wrongful conviction, we write about criminal justice, we're both recently on the board of the Ohioans to Stop Executions. It's a nonprofit that's actively involved now in advocating to eliminate Ohio's death penalty. It is, I think, an important resource to help isolate these issues where the death penalty is clearly going to be the wrong outcome, and we need to start reconsidering our laws. And we think we see more and more of the voters and the public kind of gravitating toward that position. Interestingly, OTSE, has a website that gets more and more visitors that are now, you know, you can track how much attention this issue is getting locally. So people who look at it and go to OTSE.org have an opportunity to see some of the faults of the death penalty nationally and look for ways to begin advocating on their own part the logical view of not undertaking the risk of executions where you might be wrong, where you're going to spend more money governmentally than otherwise might be the case, and where injustice could ultimately be the result.
The death penalty disproportionately affects poor people and African Americans.
It does.
Is that a concern?
Yes. Again, that comes down to the uniformity thing that I mentioned.
Okay.
The uniformity comes from a lot of factors. You know, what is the view of a county? What is the view of a county prosecutor? What are the views of judges within that county? There is no single place with uniformity with others in and around Ohio. Every county is a little different. Some counties may embrace it politically. Some may choose not to. You know, I can tell you that I'd much rather be convicted of a capital crime in some counties where I would not even face the risk of execution because they just don't do it there. Again, that lack of uniformity is a major consideration in doing away with it.
It's an argument against its constitutionality.
Absolutely. And it's also just a logical argument that says justice has to be blind, and it has to function across the spectrum of criminal conduct with some, you know, basic fairness and equality to how it's being applied. And that is not the case, nor has it ever been the case with the death penalty. And so I think that's one major reason that we advocate for getting rid of it. It has a total unfairness that can never be justified.
Jim Pietro, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Great. Good to be with you, Ann. Thank you.
It's former Ohio Attorney General Jim Pietro. He and his wife, Nancy, co-wrote a book. It's entitled False Justice, 8 Myths That Convict the Innocent. We'll continue our conversation with a proponent of the death penalty coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Support for the death penalty has reached a new low. The Pew Research Center reports that for the first time in nearly 50 years, fewer than half of Americans favor capital punishment. Still, 30 states, including Ohio, have the death penalty. And after a nearly three-year hiatus because of a shortage of drugs to carry out the executions, Ohio will resume them early next year. Today, we're talking about why and why not the death penalty again. Joining us by phone is criminal and constitutional law professor at New York Law School and author of The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst, Robert Blecker. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne.
You support capital punishment, not for every murderer, but for the worst of the worst. What do we mean by that?
Well, actually, as Daryl Holton, someone I met on death row and spent a lot of time with, corrected me, he said, I really mean it for the worst of the worst of the worst. What do we mean by that? We mean mass murderers, terrorists, rapist murderers, child killers, serial killers. You know, the next person up in Ohio, if Ohio resumes the death penalty, raped and murdered a three-year-old child of his girlfriend. That qualifies.
Okay, so but we know also that lots of other kinds of people, lots of who have committed other kinds of murders, are also on death row.
Yes, they are, and we have an obligation to morally refine the death penalty. Unfortunately, the two sides have been drawn rather starkly: either stand pat and keep it as is, although some even want to expand it, or eliminate it entirely. But there's a middle ground, and that's the ground that I occupy, which is to refine it. By the way, you mentioned right before your break about the latest Pew poll. Gallup poll still has a majority in support, and you neglected to mention that while the Pew poll has support dipping under 50%, there's still more people who are in favor of the death penalty than oppose it. And also, notice the question that they asked in that very poll, which is, are you in favor of the death penalty for someone convicted of murder? Well, if I'm asked that question, you essentially asked me that question in the opening. My answer has to be no, because in 90% of the time, I'm not in favor of the death penalty for someone convicted of murder. So should I be counted as an abolitionist? Again, if they ask the question honestly and fairly, are you in favor of the death penalty for someone who rapes and then murders a three-year-old child? You'll see whether you get 48% only in favor of the death penalty.
But, you know, there's one thing to have the spirit of a law, right? And there's another thing to carry out that spirit of the law. And you know, that has, you know, as a law professor, you know, that that's that happens all over the place. There's a contrast with that, as there is with the death penalty. So how do you, you know, you talk about refining the law. How does that work when each state can refine it in its own way? Each county can carry it out or not in its own way.
Well, I heard the end of that discussion. It's very interesting. For one thing, we committed ourselves. I'm also a professor of constitutional history, and I'm very conscious of the deal that we made in 1788 when we ratified the United States Constitution. And that was that it is primarily for each state to define, detect, prosecute, and punish crime the way its citizens see fit, subject to certain constitutional regularities and constitutional minima. So it does not disturb me that some states have abolished the death penalty and some states keep it. It morally disturbs me that some of the states who have abolished it for people who deserve to die. And it also morally offends me that some of the states who keep it include felony murder, which is on the grounds they believe wrongly that people who rob and then kill while they have robbed from a pecuniary motive necessarily kill from a pecuniary motive. I've spent, you didn't mention it, nor should you necessarily, but I've spent 3,000 hours over the last three decades on death rows and in maximum security prisons with killers, interviewing them and probing their attitudes and their life circumstances and their stories, etc. So I've the result of that has awakened me to the vast distinctions among murderers themselves. So any poll question that says, are you in favor of the death penalty for someone who commits murder, and anyone who just says yes, fails to understand the differences and the subtleties. But the jury understands them. The jury gets presented with that in the penalty phase. The jury gets the background of the killer. The jury gets the detailed circumstances of the killing. The jury gets to probe the attitudes. The jury gets to probe the people who are closest to the killer, the people who are closest to the victim. So these poll questions that broadly paint in brushstrokes that have no resemblance to reality do not adequately or accurately reflect the voice and the sentiment of the people.
But the jury also so often is working with inaccurate information, and that's where the whole Innocence Project comes in, right?
I'm not quite sure I know what you mean by that.
Well, a lot of times that it's that there are people who have been convicted who are innocent.
Yes, and you stated that very carefully. Notice you did not say there are people who have been executed who are innocent. Although there may well have been.
Yeah.
If there have been in the modern era dates from 1972 when the United States Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty as constitutional. And my guess is we have executed an innocent person, probably very few. The standard figure that's bandied about that comes from the Death Penalty Information Center, which is an avowedly abolitionist organization, though a generally fairly reliable one. The standard figure is that 130 people who have been sentenced to die and later exonerated. But exonerated does not mean proven to be innocent. There are many reasons why people who have been condemned to die and should have been killed, nevertheless, will not end up being executed nor even retried for it, because the witnesses are dead. There are problems with the way the evidence was gathered, not necessarily with the reliability of that evidence, but with the constitutionality of the gathering process. The prosecutor wrongly withheld information that she or he should have turned over to the defense attorney. There are a number of reasons that may not at all go to the guilt or innocence or the desert of the person. Again, let's not lose sight of who we're talking about. It's first up for Ohio, someone who raped and murdered a 3-year-old. I am morally certain that a person who does that deserves to die. Let's also remember one other thing, which is, compared to what? The death penalty is better or less good than what? Than life without parole in prison? If you visit the prisons and you see the quality of life inside, you would probably be appalled. As I say, I've been to prisons in 16 states. I've been not all over by any means, but have a wide enough sample, and probably a wider one than almost any study, to really judge the quality of life. And life for these lifers without parole ranges state by state, but it can include first run movies, exercise. I was on not just exercise, but sports, but play. I recently visited, before I testified before the Pennsylvania legislature, I visited Graitersford Prison, which is one of their largest prisons, a third or a quarter of which houses convicted murderers. And I went down to the exercise fields, the play fields, to the size of about 4 football fields. And I saw some very good softball games going on and other sports. And then I asked to return the next day. And the officer said to me, who was accompanying me, he said, well, you know, it's almost done. Exercise period is almost over. I said, I'd like to go down there anyway and just soak up the ambiance. So I went down there, and it was only about 20 minutes to go in the exercise period, and hundreds of guys were sitting on the steps waiting to go back in and take their hot showers, and a couple of people were playing volleyball, a few people were playing volleyball on the far end of the field, and a few were playing handball, but the vast majority were just sitting there. And it didn't strike me until a few days later what I had seen was profound, which is, with 20 minutes to go of playtime, they had enough playing. They had played all they wanted to. The next thing they wanted to do was to take a hot shower and then probably watch television. These include people who have raped and murdered 3-year-olds. So when you decide whether you're in favor or against the death penalty, don't decide it in a vacuum. Ask yourself, compared to what? Compared to life without parole. And life without parole is not a number. It's a quality. It's an experience. And so take the time and trouble to find out what our alternative actually is in practice.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the death penalty. Questions are arising again. Americans are questioning it. My guest right now, Robert Blecker. He's a New York Law School constitutional and criminal law professor. He supports the death penalty for the worst of the worst. Okay, so what about changing those circumstances of life without parole?
Well, you can't do it. I mean, there's no public support. There would be if the public knew of the circumstances, but
there has been in Ohio. I know it. I covered it as a state.
Do you know where you find your opposition? Oddly, you find your opposition among the departments of corrections, who will be the first ones to resist that kind of change.
Because?
And for very understandable reasons.
Yeah.
They want to go home at night. that it becomes slightly more dangerous. If we see, it's nobody's job to punish. That's, by the way, the title of the book that I wrote is not The Punishment of Death. It's The Death of Punishment. It's nobody's job to punish. As I've watched these guys, I watched Danny Rawling playing the ninja killer, these serial killers playing volleyball, playing chess, playing basketball. And you ask the officers, how do you feel about that? Do you know what these guys did? And one of the responses is, well, I try not to know what these guys did. What a guy did out there is none of my business. I only care how he behaves once he's inside. If he's an obedient inmate, then I'm going to treat him like an obedient inmate and someone I can rely on. So it's not my job to punish, they say. It's the judge's job to punish. Mm-hmm. Then you talk to the judges, and they say, it's not my job to punish. I just sentenced them. It's the legislator's job to punish. Then you talk to the legislatures, and they say, it's not my job to punish. It's corrections. Nobody in this society who's in an official capacity is avowedly agreeing that it is their job to punish.
Hmm. Let's take some calls right now. Frank in Lima, you're on the air. Hi, Frank.
Morning.
Go ahead.
I am one for the...
Hey, Frank, could you wait just a second and pull that phone away from your mouth a little bit?
Okay.
That,
yeah.
Oh, so much better. Thank you.
I am one for the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in trouble. As far as like he's talking about the worst of the worst of the worst. Well, there's really, I don't believe in the worst of the worst of the worst. If a man pulls out a gun and shoots somebody point blank over a dollar bill, he's just as guilty and deserves death just as a man that raped a child. Now, I a lot of people say no to the death penalty, like he's saying. And I agree, but think if it was your child that got hurt.
You're talking about killing a child for a dollar. That's a little bit different. But it says here that you think, especially since prison is so expensive, you support the death penalty.
That's what it is. And prisons are sweet. I'll straight out tell you, I've been in one, and death row is a joke. The penitentiary I was in, I basically had the run of it. I lived almost like I lived out on the street.
But you weren't on death row.
No, I was not. But I was with death row people. I was actually...
Okay.
I'm just going to say I was the captain's clerk.
Okay.
And I'll leave it at that because I'm not going to get...
All right.
I could go and get these guys anything they wanted. And there was no lockdown for 24 hours.
Okay.
It's like he's saying, if they was... The guards look at, they don't look at our crimes. They just look at who we are. And if you act accordingly, they can get out and walk and do just as a...
Okay. But, well, let's hear. Let's, Robert Blecker, let's talk about that, because Frank's made the point, and, you know, he obviously supports the death penalty for anyone who pulls out a gun and shoots somebody. But he does, you know, also think that it's cheaper.
I have a number of responses.
Okay.
I mean, there are some parts of what he said with which I agree and some parts with which I disagree. First of all, yes, he may not have been on death row, but I've been on death rows. And on Tennessee's death row, I was walking down the hall. I hadn't gone there yet, and I heard a pounding, a rhythmic pounding. And I asked the officer who was accompanying me, what is that? He said, oh, yes, you'd like to see this. And we entered a room, and there were 20 guys pounding away at leather, doing leather work with mallets, and there were sharp chisels. This was death row, by the way. This was Tennessee's death row's arts and crafts room. Let that sink in for a second. An arts and crafts room on death row? Is that possible? Is that defensible? Now, it's not universal. On the other hand, so yes, and by the way, some of the worst criminals on the outside are the biggest cowards. That's why they prey on the vulnerable, on the elderly, on the weak, on the helpless, on the children. Once they're confronted with state power on the inside in prison, they turn into pussycats. They become the most compliant. They'll listen to anybody who's more powerful than they are. Therefore, they will end up, and they'll be lifers, therefore, ironically and indefensibly, they will end up with the best jobs, the best hustles, legal and illegal, within the prison. So some part of that, obviously, I agree with. But there's some part of what he said with which I disagree.
Hmm.
Look, you rob someone, and this didn't sit well with many people on the right. I get most of my hate mail from the right, by the way. I get some from the left, but I get most of it from the right.
Hmm.
There's a big difference I've come to learn among robbers. One guy robs, and in the course of robbing, he looks and he notices that there's someone watching the robbery from a window upstairs. He counts. He says, okay, third floor, third window, goes up the stairs, breaks into the apartment, and kills the person in order to eliminate the witness. He deserves to die. But there is another kind of robber, someone who robs, and for example, his cohort gets caught and turns him in to the police, and then he kills him. He doesn't deserve to die. Or someone who resists the robbery. Look, you have every right to resist a robbery, and it's a brave thing, but it's a foolish thing to do when someone's got a gun on you. But if you resist the robbery and you go for the gun and the robber shoots you, he's terrible, and kills you. He deserves a life in prison, but he doesn't deserve to die for it. So there are gradations. There are moral gradations. It's partly a function of attitude. Look, if someone killed my child, of course my instincts would be to kill him, heaven forbid. But he might have killed my child by accidentally running through a stop sign, or in the worst case, my child may have run out to get a ball and gone right. My instinct would be rage and to attack, but I would be wrong, and I should be restrained, and hopefully would be restrained by the law. That's why we put the law between us, and that's why we put juries between us. And we have successive filtration systems of first the prosecutor who looks at the evidence and decides whether to go for the indictment, and then the grand jury that decides whether to indict.
But Robert Blecker, what about prosecutors who are pressured by county commissioners to not go for the death penalty because the county can't afford it?
Yes, there is a great diversity county to county. It's an interesting and difficult issue, because that returns to the earlier part of our conversation. On the one hand, the deal that we made in 1788 was that it was for each state for itself to define, detect, prosecute, and punish crime the way it sees fit. And therefore, we do want diversity across the United States. Now the question is, do we want the same diversity within a state? The criminal law of a state is uniform to that state. So the argument could be that since we're all under the everyone within a given state is under the same murder statute, that murder statute ought to be equally and uniformly applied. And there's very respectable opinion that holds that decisions as to whether to go for death should be centralized, and they should be made obviously blindly as to race and ethnicity, but they should be made uniformly from a central part of the state, never the United States, but of the state. So that each county, you're absolutely right. Counties have different resources. Counties have different populations, though. You might get a county whose elected prosecutor representing the will of that county reflects an anti-death penalty sentiment. That prosecutor, A, may not have the money to go for death. B, may be realistic in predicting that he'll never or she'll never get death, because at least one juror will hold out for life, never be able to get a death-prone juror, and so it may not be worth it. Another prosecutor with much more resources in a much more death-prone county may go for the death penalty. Well, there are two ways of looking at that. One way of looking at it is that each prosecutor is reflecting her or his constituency, and that ideally we want local justice at a level even more local than the central state. The other way of looking at it is that the state legislature has enacted a penal law that is supposed to be uniformly applied, and therefore all the counties should have the same degree of willingness to go or reluctance to go for death. That's not an easily resolvable issue as to how you take federalism and how local you get with it.
Just one more question before Barry in Bowling Green, you're on the air. Hi, Barry.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I have another approach to this subject. I've never been locked up in a prison, but I was involved for 25 years in the prison ministry. And the reason I got involved was because my first cousin's wife was murdered by a serial killer who was later caught and convicted of killing, I think, 14 or 15 girls. And he's still sitting in prison. One thing I noted in my prison visits, there's very few guilty people in prison. You talk to any of them, and most of them right off the bat are innocent. They didn't do, but they're convicted by a jury of their peers under the common law of the United States of America, which your
no,
guess
they're not.
Is, that's where it begins. The law says that we have the right to put these kinds of people to death, and it's the cost involved. And perhaps your statement that you just made, your guest just made, Dr. Blecker, about the cost involved. Perhaps the state, if the state has a death penalty, the state ought to have a fund that will assume the cost of a county who doesn't have the financial wherewithal.
That if the state decides if it's centralized in that way, then also the funding be centralized?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. I mean, that's the way the Justice Department does it. The ultimate decision, it's based upon an initial recommendation by the local United States attorney when they go for death under the federal death penalty statute, although the vast majority of death penalties are not under the federal statute. They're under state by state. Mm-hmm. But the way the feds do it is that ultimately the centralized decision-making process takes place in Washington with the Justice Department upon recommendation by the local United States attorneys, which is a recommendation. They get a voice, but they don't determine whether to go or not go. So it is a centralized procedure. As I say, the reasonable minds can differ on that. Mm-hmm. One view is that justice should be localized. Ideally, if you go back to the Magna Carta, local justice, that was one of the great advances. And so if you've got a city or a county that's strongly in favor of certain kinds of conditions of punishment in prison and the death penalty, well, then their views ought to be reflected. As long as they're constitutional, they ought to be reflected.
Well, likewise, a city or county vote to abolish the death penalty?
Well, that's good. That's a fair question. And, of course, the answer is you can't vote to abolish it in the sense that it binds the state, but you can effectively vote to abolish it by electing prosecutors who won't go for it. Okay. Like Robert Morgenthau, who was the district attorney in Manhattan, used to say, when I get the appropriate case, I will go for the death penalty. He was lying. He never went for the death penalty. He never would go for the death penalty. He had every case imaginable under the sun of the worst of the worst of the worst of the worst. He never went because he was an abolitionist. Finally, he got honest when he was 90 years old and admitted, I will never go for the death penalty. And he never did. So in effect, Anne, you get exactly that. You get local prosecutors who simply won't go for the death penalty.
Well, Robert Blecker, we have to move on, but I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Robert Blecker, New York Law School, Constitutional and Criminal Law Professor. His book is called The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. More All Sides coming up on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about capital punishment this hour. New polling shows that support for the death penalty continues to fall to historic lows, but 30 states, including Ohio, still enforce capital punishment. In recent years, lawmakers in New Mexico, Illinois, Connecticut, Maryland, and Nebraska have abolished the death penalty. The Nebraska legislature voted in 2015 to abolish the death penalty and even got the votes to override a veto. In November, Nebraska voters will reconsider the question on the statewide ballot. Instrumental in that legislative vote was Nebraska Republican State Senator Colby Cohash. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
Senator Cohash, you identify as a conservative Republican. It's a nonpartisan legislature. That's why I make that distinction. What changed your mind about the death penalty?
Well, there were a lot of things that led to my decision. But from a policy perspective, you know, when I got in the legislature 8 years ago, we were talking about this issue. And at that time, it had been 22 years since we had last done an execution. Next year will be the 30th year since we've actually had an execution. And as a policymaker, I just looked at it at a very practical level and said, you know what we have here is a system that's broken. You know, when I went door to door and asked for votes, I would tell my constituents, look, if you send me to the Capitol and I find a broken government program, I'll get rid of it. And we looked, and my colleagues on both sides of the aisle looked at the death penalty and said, you know what, this is wasting money. We're not using it. We haven't used it despite will to use it, despite limited opposition to using it. And we took a very practical approach and said, this is a waste of money, this is broken government. And you know, also, as conservative members of the legislature, you know, we're supposed to be the check on a growing government, too big government, government that's too powerful. And when we looked at the death penalty through that lens, we weren't comfortable with that either. And so you put all those things together, and at the end of the day, we just felt like we were doing a practical thing, well, getting rid of a program that's not working.
Well, what equates not using the death penalty for 30 years with broken?
Well, if there was a program in our health and human services realm, for example, that we had on the books, and the program wasn't being used, or it was being used inefficiently, believe me, we would have found that program and said, well, we're not using it. It's not working. We're going to get rid of it. Our definition of a program that's working is a program that where the taxpayer is getting what he or she is paying for. And at the end of the day, we had a program that taxpayers were funding that they weren't getting what they're paying for. Nobody was being executed, no matter what people tried. And so it for us, it became this issue of, you know what, let's put this behind us so we can get on to more important things that do affect the citizens of our state.
Well, was it, I guess I'm trying to understand, were people on death row, but they couldn't, because of the drug shortage for the executions, couldn't get access to the drugs? I mean, what was broken about it? Just because it wasn't being used, maybe Nebraska's a really law-abiding state and people aren't committing heinous crimes.
Well, to answer your question, first of all, we had right now we have 10 people on death row. We had at one point up to 11. The guy who, and the reason I went from 11 to 10 is that a guy who had been on death row for over 30 years died of natural causes.
Okay.
So in other words, he had a sentence of death that was never carried out. And we kind of looked at it like this: look, a sentence that's not carried out isn't that's justice denied. And it just seemed terribly inefficient. We have people on our death row been there for decades, and we can't get the drugs in our state because we do it in a very transparent way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's become the barrier. Believe me, we had a governor and an attorney general who were more willing to sign a death warrant. They couldn't get it done, and it was despite their best efforts to do so.
Still, a large majority of Republicans, about 77%, according to a recent Pew poll, support the death penalty. Where's the fault line in your party on this issue?
Well, we have a Republican majority in our legislature.
Right.
And we had more Republicans vote for the abolition of the death penalty than we did Democrats.
Hmm.
And it was really done not because of a party line issue. It just became a very mm-hmm. practical issue that, look, we're about efficient government. We're about limited government, and this just doesn't meet the sniff test in either of those cases.
You know, as I mentioned, Nebraska's legislature in 2015 mustered the votes to override a veto by Governor Pete Ricketts, but the governor's throwing his financial resources behind the ballot measure in November. How's that issue polling at this time? What do you know about how Nebraska voters feel about it?
Well, it's close. I can tell you that. We have a very diverse state, and we have a couple of very urban areas and a large rural area. And the ideas on the death penalty are very, very diverse. I can tell you this. My father-in-law, for example, he's a farmer in central Nebraska and pretty, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Republican, you know, hang 'em high kind of guy. And even when I told him, he says, why aren't you killing them? You know, and I said, look, we can't do it, and we're wasting money. And even he came around and said, well, if it's not working, just get rid of it, you know. So, you know, our hope is that Nebraskans will see this issue for what it is, which is just kind of a broken thing that's distracting us from some real work we have to do in our state. And so we'll see what happens. The governor is an independently wealthy man. He owns the Cubs with his family. And he decided to put his own resources into this ballot initiative, and we'll see how that plays out.
You know, you had a change of heart about the moral issue of the death penalty. When you visited a prison in 1994,
right.
you witnessed some things that troubled you and started to make you think differently about it. What do we know, or what do you know, and what have you learned about how minds are changed on this issue? How often is it a moral thing versus, say, a financial bottom line kind of a thing?
Well, certainly some of my colleagues came at this issue from a moral standpoint, a very faith-based standpoint. Many of my colleagues couldn't reconcile their beliefs in protecting the unborn with condemning the, killing the condemned. And another colleague of mine said very eloquently that his faith taught him that until your last breath, you are you're able to be saved, and who are we to take that opportunity away? But what really we're talking about is like public safety. And the reality is, in Nebraska, and I believe across our country, there's nobody sitting in death row that's in danger of getting out. We have good prisons. People don't, I mean, nobody in death row is going to jump the fence, right? So we can keep the public safe, and we don't have to go through the expense. My feeling is that that's a worse punishment. I got letters from death row inmates when I was going through this saying, stop doing this, you know, because my thought is they ought to walk a hole in their cell floor, 12 by 12, until they take their last breath. That's justice. And I've never been on the victim side of things, so I can't speak for victims. But it was just a terribly unfair thing to victims that we seem to put them through in our state. If you are a victim's family who wants to see an execution, you never see it. If you're a victim's family who doesn't want to see an execution, the state continues to try and fail. And it just, at the end of the day, neither one of those victims' needs are being met. And that just seemed unfair. And that's part of the reason we left it behind us.
Richard in Columbus, you're on the air with Nebraska State Senator Colby Koash. Hi, Richard.
Yes. And I have a question. In the Bible, we have God's Ten Commandments. And one of the commandments is, thou shalt not kill. It doesn't make any difference whether you're doing it to correct a problem, such as an execution from government against killers or what. He said, thou shalt not kill. Killing is not a solution for the human race to use to correct anything, including sin.
So
lawyer, mm-hmm. How can they resolve that thing with a higher power than any and all governments and we humans, higher than anything in this creation? And when he says he's willing to come back and judge us if we disobey him, and he's very patient in that, and how does a lawyer reconcile that situation and think that we're on the right path to, as they say, glory land as far as a nation?
Okay, Richard, thank you very much. Richard takes the, classical moral argument against the death penalty, Senator Koash.
That commandment, I don't know how you can get more clear than that. and certainly that was part of our debate. We heard a lot from the opponents of our effort. God also said eye for an eye. And you have to kind of, theologians all tell us, take those things into context. And, I had this really interesting argument with one of my colleagues about this, and he was going through the eye for an eye issue, and in that same part of the Bible, also says don't eat pork, and we have a lot of pig farmers in our state, so you have to be unfortunately, I found the Bible was used on both sides of this issue a little bit disingenuously, and that was disappointing, but certainly, like I said earlier, people came at it with their faith. And people came at it for their moral convictions and certainly their duties as lawmakers as well.
Nebraska State Senator Colby Koash, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you for your time. I'll be coming to Ohio to speak to some groups there. So I'm looking forward to coming to the Buckeye State.
All right. Well, welcome. Thanks to the All-Sides staff as well. Producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All-Sides interns Walter Hopp, Jessica Shakespeare, and Shelby Powers, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. I'm there too. That's at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.